Hi everyone, Chat Cemetery is back, as is Tim Matthews. This time we're talking about the Pet Cemetery book, which, in case you haven't noticed, kind of spurred the name for this podcast. And it is one of the books that I had not read before. I've mentioned on this podcast probably numerous times by now that I will be reading a lot of these things for the first time. So to have that experience with this one, kind of knowing a little bit of what it was about going into it, just because it's one of those books you tend to hear about a lot, especially with the new movie coming up pretty soon here. Actually, the movie might be out by the time you are all listening to this. We'll have to wait and see, or it'll be very close. But either way, it's coming, and I think a lot of people have been diving into this book more recently too. So, Tim, did you end up rereading this recently, or was it something that you had read a while ago and just really wanted to talk about because you like the book so much?
So I actually only read it for the first time this past like November, I guess.
Okay.
Because I had started reading a bunch of spooky books in October, and then Pet Cemetery just spilled over into November. It was always one that I wanted to read, and my dad had always told me like how good this one was, and he had a bunch of the Stephen King books when I was growing up, and I was only allowed to read certain ones when I was younger. So now I'm like catching up a bit. So this one was relatively recent for me. I had seen the original movie, when I was younger.
Yeah. So we're pretty much in the same boat here. I have not seen the original movie though. I was saving that because I was like, okay, I know I need to read the book, and I know the movie came out a few years after the book. So I was like, all right, I'm just going to force myself to do this in order here. So anytime I have not read a Stephen King book yet, I'm making myself wait to watch the movies, even though, you know, it's so tempting to watch the movies because you can sit down and be done in less than 2 hours in most cases with these adaptations. And I was like, nope, can't do that. But with this book, it was longer than I thought it was. When I was looking at the book on the shelf, I was like, oh, that's maybe 300 pages. And it was a little over 400, which wasn't a big deal. You know, I think we can dive into the pacing of the book here real quick, because I thought that this one was actually very well paced. And I've been hearing that this is a lot of people's favorite Stephen King book. And I know we're both in the Chorus FM forums, so to have people talking about it there and everything too, I was like, all right, I think this is one I will really, really enjoy. And, you know, you start out with this big move for the Creed family, and then you have all of these events that happen one right after the other pretty much, and it really just keeps the story going at a nice pace. And sometimes you're like, wait, 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 I kind of want you to slow down here because there's so much going on. I need to take it all in. And since I ended up reading a good chunk of this book in the last few days alone, I was like, oh, wow, this is a lot to process. But it was still so nicely paced that I didn't really mind it. You know, sometimes books will start out a little slow. And I felt this way with The Stand in particular, one, because it's a pretty big book, but two, because it's like, all right, are we getting to the point here? And then they do, and it really picks up the pace. And with this one, it was just nicely done throughout. And I was like, oh, okay, this is very pleasant to read, even though it's not at the same time for other reasons.
Yeah, exactly. It's a pretty simple plotted out story, but it flows so nicely, but it also still feels like you're getting enough time to like spend time with the characters to actually like care about, you know, his growing friendship with Judd and things like that. You know, sometimes those character things either get sacrificed for the more, you know, exciting plot points, or other times, sometimes those character building moments can take a bit too long, and you're like, I get it. Like these people are developing a really good friendship, but nothing's happening. Can we speed this along? And Stephen King books, definitely walk that tightrope from book to book. But this one definitely, has a really nice flow to it, and it feels natural the way it paces.
Plus, you have the fact that there aren't too many characters in this one. And I feel like when you have a book like The Stand, it's a little different because you have various groups of characters that you're following. And you have various characters in this one, but for the most part, they're in the same area. You know, they live across the street from each other and they work with Lewis. And then you have the parents in Chicago. So you aren't really spending too much time with the people that Lewis works with. And you aren't spending too much time with Rachel's parents in Chicago because they aren't right around the house for the most part. A lot of this story has to do with the house and Ludlow in general. So you are kind of in one setting for a good chunk of the book. And I think that helps with the pacing too, because one, it doesn't get boring. You're never feeling like, oh, we're spending too much time at this one place. Instead, it's like, oh, what's going to happen next at this place?
Definitely. Yeah, I did this book with Audible, and it was narrated by Michael C. Hall. And I was like, oh, that'll be fun to have Dexter read Pet Sematary. But like Stephen King books, a lot of the time, I'm not able to do the audiobook version because of how many characters there are. And it's just because it's just, if I don't have all those names visually in front of me and they start talking about some character, I'm like, wait, who's in this scene? Who's talking? I have no idea what's going on. But it's like, at least like if I have the book in front of me, you know, maybe I need to take notes, but at least I have the names right there. And I'm like, okay, it's immediately after that comment. And I can follow this easily. And that being able to do that with Pet Sematary showed how simplistic this book is. And that's not a criticism at all. Like it was just easy to follow along just with the audio version.
Sometimes I think some of Stephen King's books should have like character lists at the front of the book, which obviously if you're doing an audiobook, that doesn't help you quite as much because you can't just flip back to the front of the book and see who the characters are. But I think that has been used in some books, not necessarily Stephen King books, but just in general. And I really wish any book that has a lot of characters in it would do that. You know, I've been rereading the Harry Potter books too, and there are so many characters in Harry Potter, but for whatever reason, probably because I've seen all of the movies, I don't get those characters as confused because I've had that visualization of them in the movies and everything like that.
Yeah,
but still, it's kind of like, oh, okay, wait, is this student in Slytherin or, you know, Hufflepuff or whatever? It would kind of be nice sometimes to just have that information handy. But
it should be if you have beyond a certain amount of characters, you're required to put that in the front of your book.
Yeah, that should kind of be a thing that publishers should start making note of, because it would be very, very helpful. I know sometimes people, when they're reading books, will like do that themselves and sort of just make a list. Okay, this character has these traits and whatnot, which, you know, that's a lot of work for the reader to do.
It is.
But I digress, and we can hop on into the story now, because really the story revolves around the Creed family, and their neighbors across the way, Judd and Norma, are almost like these mother and father like figures for them while they're in this new place. They don't really know anyone. Lewis is starting a new job, but Rachel is sort of just home with the kids. And obviously, the kids are young enough to the point where Ellie's going to go to school, she'll make friends, she'll be fine. Gage is still a toddler, so he's just going to do his thing and kind of tear up the place.
Yeah. Yeah, when you got, you're moving to this brand new place, he's got a brand new job, she's going to start a brand new school. And then you have a stay-at-home mom who has to juggle adapting to the new location, but also dealing with the newborn. And is he a medical teacher? Is that,
he's a doctor and he basically works at the college's infirmary.
Okay,
so he's an actual medical doctor and he's there to sort of just be on campus for any medical needs that the students have, because I know when I was going to Drexel, they had like a doctor's office somewhere on campus, and it probably helps that they also had like a nursing program and everything too. So, you know, I think it was more along those lines. And he had a few colleagues who worked in the office with him, because on his first day of work, that's when this horrible accident happens. Right. And they bring in one of the students, and he ends up dying basically like in the waiting room. And it's sort of this turning point too for the story, along with Judd taking Lewis to the pet cemetery after he sees that Church, the family cat, has been hit by a car or something crossing the road. So you have that happen while Rachel and the kids happen to be gone. So that's helpful too, because it's like, okay, they'll never know that you went here, even though Rachel is very, very adamant that they don't go there again after Judd takes the entire family there.
Yeah, that's an odd like hike. Let me take you up to show you where all the dead animals are.
Yeah, and I think he did it more so because it was on their property technically still, yeah, or something to that effect. So he was like, hey, you know, this is here, don't be alarmed by it. But as we see later, he and Lewis go deeper into the woods, and that's when you get into trouble with this whole pet cemetery thing. At first, it's sort of just this harmless thing. Oh, you know, people bury their pets here and they stay there.
Yeah.
But beyond the pet cemetery, when you get to, I believe it was called the Micmac territory.
Yeah.
You have this burial ground where things come back to life. And most people take pets there, which is what they do with Church while Rachel and the kids are gone. So they have no idea that anything has happened to Church. They blame it on him getting fixed. Oh, he's a little weird now. So he just got fixed. So that's why. And, you know, I guess if you are gone and that's the only thing that's really happened in your absence, that would make sense in their head, especially with Ellie, because she probably doesn't really know what it means for a cat to get fixed because she's still pretty young. But I get the feeling she's smarter than your average kid.
She definitely knows there's something up with it, with the cat. And I always got the feeling that it's like she doesn't buy like what her parents' like excuse for it is. But at the same time, it's her cat, and she has no reason to, you know, suspect that it's a zombie cat. So, you know, she still loves her cat, but is also kind of like, it's kind of like, Church is kind of a jerk now. Like, and he really smells.
Which happens to a lot of animals, so not that weird again, but still, it's probably pretty alarming if your cat has not smelled that way before, and then all of a sudden they start smelling that way.
Yeah.
But I think the big turning point in the book comes with Gage's death, because right when they move in, they have this big, loud truck go by, and Judd even makes a comment about watching the kids around the road.
Right.
And it's not that Rachel and Lewis weren't watching him. It's just that he had too much of a head start and ran right into the road in front of a truck before Lewis could get to him. So you have this big traumatic event that happens and really is the catalyst for the book. And ultimately, this book just ends up being a huge lesson in grief and how you manage that, because Lewis goes so far as to take Gage out of his grave, and he does this through kind of a crazy string of events, and he takes him to the burial ground where he'll come back to life. And Judd had warned him specifically about not burying people there.
I think they're just kind of like, they're having a conversation about the cemetery, and I think this is after they already like that took Church there and everything. And I think he tries to just inquire, like, has anyone ever brought like a person in there? And Judd like gets like really upset about it. And
but he does tell him the story later about the guy who did take his son there.
Yeah.
And it's still before everything. Yeah. It's still before everything unfolds with Gage. So, true. You know, he's telling Lewis, you're going to have this idea, but don't do it. Because it was right after Gage's death. I don't think they had even buried him yet when Judd comes over. And he tells Lewis this story because in his gut, he knows that Lewis is already thinking about it. And he knows because the place just has this hold over people who have been to it. And as soon as they buried Church there, it was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Now this is going to be a problem.
Yeah, now because, he knows the power.
Right. And the burial ground is going to try and lure Lewis back there because it knows he's lost someone else now.
It's messed up.
To say the least. Yeah. And, you know, it's one of those things where the pet cemetery isn't really the point of the book. I understand why it's the title of the book, but it's not sort of the point of focus. It's like, hey, here's this weird thing on your property. And it makes sense in a way. You know, a lot of people will just bury their animals in their backyard or something like that. But there are literal pet cemeteries out there. So when you're out in the middle of nowhere, something like this kind of makes sense. You know, the houses seem pretty spread out and there's lots of land. So it's like, hey, why don't we just sort of make a little community pet cemetery, much in the way people would have like community gardens and stuff like that. That's really what it felt like to me. It was more about the area and the community that surrounded this pet cemetery and how the burial grounds could just rope you back in anytime it wanted, pretty much.
I think the overall theme of everything is the having the ability to accept that death is an inevitability, even if it happens, at an unexpected time. You know, no parent, you know, should have to, you know, lose their child, but you have to accept it and you have to grow from it and move on from it. Whereas the cemetery and the power of the cemetery, it's like the ultimate antagonist to that, because everyone has at some point in their life, if they've lost someone, have had that thought of, you know, what would you do if you could bring somebody back? And I think that's one of the reasons this book resonates so well with the terror of it, because it's like, as you're sitting there reading it, you're like, I'd like to think I wouldn't, you know, take something to the cemetery, but I don't know if I was in that situation and I knew that there was that power there. I mean, maybe if I knew that they'd come back as super zombies and murder everybody, but.
Another thing that I found really interesting about the aspect of death in this book was how different Rachel and Lewis's opinions were of death. Rachel went through this traumatic event with her sister that sort of ruined the subject for her. Not that death is ever a pleasant subject, but most people won't react the way that Rachel does when death is brought up, even the death of a pet or something like that. Mm-hmm. And just the fact that she has such a harsh reaction to even discussing Church dying at some point, you know, it's one of those moments where you're like, okay, there's something more to this character. And we do slowly pick away at that throughout the book. But then with Lewis, he's very matter of fact about it. And I believe it's because of his work as a doctor. It's something he's familiar with in a very different way than how Rachel is familiar with it. Hers was traumatic. For Lewis, it's sort of just, hey, this thing happens. It's part of my work. And that's where we're going to leave it.
Yeah, it's his job. He's clinical about it. And I feel like, you know, doctors, especially, they need to have this ability to be able to just distance themselves from the reality and the emotional factor, which I feel like is one of the reasons that he goes so far off the deep end in taking Gabe up there, because I feel like he is so used to being so clinical about it that when he is reached with that traumatic moment, he really, really doesn't know how to handle it. One of the lines that I think like the big moment between the two of them is when he's talking to Ellie and I think he's talking about death and he's talking about it so matter of factly, and he's like, you know, death is natural. And I think her line is something like, there's nothing natural about death. And that's her perspective on it.
that one line too just speaks volumes towards her character as well. And I think even just how Stephen King wrote this book really brought that grief across in those different ways. You know, you have Ellie, who is kind of shutting everything in and bottling it all up, and then she's having these horrible nightmares, and they're very premonition-like. So she's another kid who sort of ends up having these abilities through a traumatic event. And I think it's very interesting how we don't really get too much of that until after Gage's death. And obviously that is sort of a turning point for Ellie as well. And she's carrying his picture around, wanting him to come back. So it's like she knows that he's going to come back at some point, but she never actually gets to see that happen.
Right.
It's just amazing how well thought out all of these characters were. And I think it helps when you have fewer characters. We probably have really 6 or 7 characters that we get to know throughout this. And what we get of Rachel's parents, it doesn't really feel as important. You know, they've always hated Lewis and vice versa, more so the father, I believe, than the mother.
Yeah, that feels pretty like, you know, typical of in-laws. Yeah. In-laws being like, you're not good enough for my daughter. And then, of course, when they lose Gage, that's like that much more ammunition for them to be like, she married the wrong man. You know, this never would have happened if it weren't for you and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, so they weren't really crucial characters. They were sort of just characters who had to be there because of the story that was being told. But you have the Creed family. So you have the two kids, the parents. You have Judd and Norma across the street. And even later on, you get a little more of Steve, one of Lewis's colleagues.
Yeah.
And he plays a crucial role for a very short amount of time. In my opinion, it's like immediately after Gage's death, he comes around and he sort of just keeps shooting Lewis these looks like, hey, you still have a family. You need to take care of them, too. And Lewis never can really bring himself to do it. So it's really Steve who gets Rachel and Ellie from the point of Gage's death through the point to where they end up going to Chicago. And even though it's not a huge amount of time in the book, it's a significant moment for them. And I think even though they weren't getting what they needed from Lewis, Steve sort of eased that transition into, okay, hey, here's what's happening. Go rest, go do this. We'll send Ellie here and, you know, sort of take care of everything while Lewis is dealing with everything in his own way because he doesn't really want to deal with it, as we find out.
Right. No, I absolutely agree. And I think that's something that, I haven't read a ton of Stephen King's books, and I've seen most of, if not all, the adaptations. But I feel like that's one a strength that he really has is being able to make such those like really impactful small characters that that it's like, all right, well, I didn't get to spend a ton of time with them, but their presence in the story is so strong, and they tend to exist for those pivotal moments, like one of them being like Halloran in The Shining. You know,
yes,
we get a bit of him in the beginning, but we lose him for a while. And then it's like when he comes back, you're like, yes, that's right. I remember why we need you. You know,
absolutely. And I like when you have characters like that who play a crucial role but don't need to be overbearing about their role necessarily. You have Steve show up when he's needed, and that's it. You don't have all of this exposition on Steve's life and everything like that. You know, we don't really know too much about Steve, really.
Yeah. One of the other small characters that is, you know, the Victor Pascal thing, you know, it's,
yeah, the student who came in and died.
Yeah. And, you know, he has these moments where, I think it's supposed to be alluded that, that the ghost of Victor Pascal actually like lures him out you know, to the cemetery to tell him about the border, and that it's like these lines are not meant to be crossed. And when I think when Lewis wakes up from that, he thinks it was just a dream, but he has dirt on his feet. But that's another example in this book of there's two characters that it's kind of doing roughly the same thing, except Victor Pascal, I feel like on one hand is serving as a warning, but I also feel like and since it's been a bit since I've read the book, I could be way off, but I also almost feel like it could play into the powers of the cemetery, that it's like, hey, we're going to bring up this conversation. You know, it seems like it's a well-meaning warning. But now that seed is just like firmly planted in Lewis's head of like, if you cross this barrier, like, yeah, there's consequences, but think of the power that's behind these barriers. And then you have Steve that is, he doesn't have any of the knowledge of all those things. So he doesn't know that this is a concern, but he knows that Lewis isn't in his right mind. And he's giving him his own warnings of you need to whip yourself into shape. You need to take care of your family. And then when he's unable to do that, Steve takes it into his own hands. And so it's, you have these two small minor characters that in their own ways can steer the entirety of the character in a good direction or possibly a horrible direction.
With Victor Pascal too, he shows up in Ellie's nightmares, and he shows up right around the same time that we figure out what exactly Lewis is going to do. So you have these two characters giving different kinds of warnings at roughly the same time, and it doesn't feel like you're getting too much at once with those two. I know sometimes, like I mentioned earlier, you almost wish the story would slow down a little and be like, okay, all right, let's take a breath. I think everyone needs it. But it sort of just keeps going and plows right into the end. And it's a very sad ending too, but we'll talk about the ending more specifically in a little bit. One of the things I wanted to bring up to you was that moment where they switch things up and tell you, oh, by the way, Gage isn't dead. This didn't really happen. But then you figure out that that is all a dream in Lewis's head. And for a moment, it had me going. I was like, wait, he's not? What happened? What's going on? It was a very good misdirect. And even though it was very short, I was like, wow, you really had me going there, Stephen King.
I feel like the fact that he keeps that short is what keeps it so impactful. I feel I wonder if he were to sit on that for a bit longer, that it would give you more time to start questioning things, more time to start looking for clues of like, wait, is like this doesn't make any sense. Like I know he went for the road. Like why like he's dead, but because it's in such a small period of time, like, he lures you in emotionally because none of us want to believe that he would kill off the small child. And so you're like, no, this is great. This is great. Awesome. Like, he's still alive. And then, well, you know, in Stephen King's wonderful way, he knows how to throw the gut punch at you just in time.
It has such an impact too with playing with your emotions throughout this book. You're like, oh, cool, the family's settled in and everything's going fine. And even though church is still a little weird, you know, for the most part, it seems like they're getting along. And obviously, it's a Stephen King book. We know that isn't going to last too long, but he gives you just enough of those good moments after they've settled in to where you're like, oh, okay. But then you have Norma's death, which was inevitable, if we're being honest, because from the moment we meet the character, she's frail and suffering from arthritis, which he depicts in a way that makes it seem very, very painful. Even though you're just reading the words, I felt like it was very easy to visualize the pain that this character was going through. And the same with Rachel, but in more of an emotional state for her.
Oh, yeah. The Rachel stuff with her sister is so so heavy. Those parts were really hard. And even in the original adaptation, like those scenes are ones where I like cringe at, because I'm like, oh, I was like, this is really messed up.
Absolutely. And it really just felt like the entire time you kind of knew what was going to come next, but you didn't really know how we would get there. I didn't think he would really end up sending Rachel and Ellie away, knowing the kind of impact it could have on them emotionally, mentally, what have you, after Gage's death. And he spins it so that Rachel believes it would be good for her and Ellie, but he's straight up lying to her face. And you're like, oh boy, all right, Lewis is really starting to spiral now. And it's that moment where you're like, oh boy, this is not going to end remotely well, is it? And I didn't really see Rachel's death coming either. I was like, oh, all right, he's over there, he's going to get Judd. That kind of makes sense, because mm-hmm. Judd is the one who introduced Lewis to this and everything. But then to have it switch things up and to go after Rachel, I was like, oh, wow, that was not expected at all.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we talked about, like, you know, this book, it moved pretty swiftly, but we talked about how in all those books, there's that moment where there's the switch and everything like really heats up, and it's just like, yeah, like Judd's gone, and you're like, oh my God, like Judd's dead. But at the same time, you kind of expected that, like, that's one that's probably going to happen. And you think, all right, any minute now, like, they're going to stop this, you know, somehow it's going to be stopped. And, the family will probably be reeling from it, but you're not expecting him to take out more members of the family. And I also wonder if, like, the fact that he does name it Pet Cemetery, it leaves this thought in your head that you're not thinking that, you know, the small child is going to be like the crucial antagonist at the end of this book. You're thinking it's going to be pets, like, it's
right.
And so that's one that's always, like, landed so hard for me. Like, even when I rewatched the adaptation, I had completely forgotten that moment. And then when I like heard the little child laughter, I'm just like, nope, no, 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 nope, nope.
We're done here. No, I know what you mean, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's just, you just can't believe it's happening, but you keep reading and you're blown away. It's all done so well in a wonderfully terrifying way.
I think titling it Pet Cemetery 2 just allows you to go back to the amount of grief that goes into something like that. You know, all of these kids lost all of these pets at one point or another. And it is basically this huge embodiment on the Creed's property of the grief that these kids felt throughout the years. And I think, in a sense, that grief sort of just piles up on that property, and it just takes over whoever is living in that house. And you don't think about that, obviously, before having read the book, but afterwards you're like, oh, okay, I kind of see the symbolism in this.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like, it's just, there's so much grief and so much just negative energy that just exists in that area, and has it's almost like essentially swallowing that area whole. Like, there's too much grief, I feel like, for that house and location to ever come back from.
Yeah. Is there anything else about the story in specific that you want to touch on before we dive into the ending even more? Because I feel like this ending is pretty crucial to just wrapping up this entire book.
No, I'm ready for the ending. I'm excited.
So this is a moment that also brings back Steve for at least a little bit. You have Lewis setting Judd's house on fire because he wants to cover up what has happened there.
Right.
And he takes Rachel's body out of the house, and he's taking her to the burial grounds, even though he knows what just happened with Gage. He was like, oh, I just waited too long. And that's his reasoning. But Steve catches up with him. he starts running up the path and calls out for Lewis. And when Lewis turns around, he's older. It, you know, his hair is described as being whiter, and you get this visualization of him just having aged so much because of what has happened in the last 24 hours, maybe even 12 hours, you know, and he's carrying Rachel knowing that he shouldn't be taking her there. And for whatever reason, he's able to lie well enough to the authorities to where they just rush it off, kind of. And you get that final one page epilogue where Rachel comes back and she just says the word darling. And I really think this is one of those times that Stephen King nailed the ending, because when we see him taking Rachel there, we know what's going to happen, but we don't need it to play out. Just having her walk back in the house and say that, that's more than enough for you to be like, oh, okay, so this is how it's going to go.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. And it's like him, you know, him covering up the what happened at the house and him, you know, lying to the police. So much of the book rests on secrets and lies and the terrible consequences that come from them. And yeah, like when he takes Rachel up there, and you could expect that you could easily see the book being written in a way that we have this, you know, final climax. So, you know, where he has to, you know, take her down, or maybe she takes him down. But it's like you can think about it either which way. But yeah, I 100% agree. Like he nails it. It's so simple. It's so chilling. And there's two parts about that last line. One, that we just get this single line of dialogue from her, but instead of him saying, darling, Rachel said, or darling, she said, it says, darling, it said. And it's just like phrasing it that way is so perfect, because it's not her. And so that is enough to just leave a chill in your spine and you to sit there with your own imagination on what happened next. I agree. This is one of my favorite endings of his. It's so good.
If I'm not mistaken, that same thing happens with Church as well. I don't know if it's Lewis who says it, but I feel like at some point someone says it instead of him, and it sort of just comes full circle with this ending. And I really like that. And, you know, I don't know if I would say that so far this is my favorite Stephen King book, but I gave it a 5 out of 5, and it's very high on the list.
This is one of my favorites of the ones I've read. Salem's Lot has always been a personal favorite of mine, but that one I can even admittedly say it takes a while to get going. And so it's like, as much as I love that book, it's the first half definitely has some pacing issues, because you're just waiting and waiting. But this one is definitely one of my favorites. And I think maybe, I don't know. I don't even know if I want to get into a ranking of them. But this one I really like.
I feel like I'm sort of going to have to keep somewhat of a tally.
And maybe I'm sure. Yeah.
By the time I catch up, which will be a few years from now. And, you know, obviously he's still announcing books and everything too. So I don't even know when this is going to end. And obviously Stephen King is in his 70s, I believe. So he won't keep writing forever, but he'll probably still manage to write enough to where it's going to add another at least few months to my podcast by the time it's all over.
Yeah, I think he just had one come out like last spring or something, or over the summer. It wasn't that long ago, and it was just
in October.
Yeah. And then it was just announced there's another one coming out in October. So it's
keeping me busy.
Yeah.
That's for sure. But yeah, I think I'm going to sort of start keeping a tally of what ones I give a 4 or 5 to. And it'll be interesting to see. Maybe at the end, I can make some sort of chart to go along with this podcast and be like, okay, here's what I ranked every single Stephen King book and movie. And obviously, if people want to keep up with that now, I am on Goodreads and Letterboxd. So that's where most of these rankings will be happening.
Yeah, I just joined Letterboxd. So I've been slowly building my library as I just discovered the app. It's very exciting.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I will be sure to link to both of our Letterboxd profiles and everything on this so people can keep up with our ratings of things, because I'm sure you will probably dive into even more Stephen King stuff at some point.
Oh, for sure. I can't wait for the adaptation of this. I think it looks really good. But if anyone hasn't watched the second trailer, I urge you to not watch it. It definitely gives away everything.
Yeah, I have not watched that. I believe I watched one of the first teasers, and I've sort of been staying away from everything since, because I was seeing headlines like, oh, Pet Sematary movie changes one big thing about the book. And I was like, nope, don't want to know.
Yeah, the first teasers were perfect. And I broke and I watched the second trailer. I'm still super excited, but I was like, wow, that's a bad trailer. Like So I feel like such is the nature of trailers these days. But yeah, I'm excited for that. I'm excited for It Chapter 2, or as Bill Hader calls it, It's. And then Dr. Sleep is, I'm sure, going to be awesome as well. So keep them coming. Keep them coming.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Tim, thank you so much for joining me to talk about this book. It was a great one to power through and get done just in time for us to record this. I was not very good at managing my time the last few weeks, so I was like, oh, better hurry.
It happens. Now, this was a good one, yeah.
But you will definitely be back on for more episodes. And if anyone wants to follow us, we're on Twitter at Chat Sematary and Instagram at Chat Sematary there as well. And as always, thank you all for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.